You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie, and we've got everybody in the studio this morning. G'day, Anila. How are you?
I'm okay. I've been up early today, had a week off, so I'm...
You're in training now.
I'm noticing the difference waking up at 5 in the morning versus having a sleep in on a Saturday.
And it's raining, so, you know, that's cute.
Yeah, I know. It's nice weather. I slept with my window open. It was like nature's ASMR.
I've got a bit of weather talk I need to bring to the table. What's going on with the allergens? I've been having the worst hay fever of my life.
No, you just live in Melbourne. You know, it's really funny because I went for a week in Hong Kong because I had to do family business, and my sinuses cleared up. And then I came back to Melbourne and they flooded again.
There's a bit of a contest between Canberrans and Melbournians about who has the highest pollen count. And every Canberran thinks it's them.
Oh, but, I can't believe
but
it. But
I swear, Melbourne, it's the most feral place on earth
it's
for allergens.
Dust. It's actually dust. I think it's dust. And you're
Look
okay?
How serious Annie got about
it. Yeah. No, I'm serious about it. No, it's debilitating for people who get affected by it.
Everyone's going to have to listen to me coughing through the whole show.
And Tabea, how was your week?
It was a big week. Yeah, I finished school. Yeah, and just been doing a bunch of stuff with Philip. I mean, today in Italy was the third general strike that they called. So it's big. It's awesome seeing all the news from it. It's really good. You had Greta Thunberg, Francesca Albanese, a bunch of other people join the rally. So it's really well spread. And the union support. I mean, I translated their joint declaration with a bunch of community organizations. But their vision is broader than probably any political party that we have here. 1 million public housing units, €2,000 minimum monthly wage, 4-day work week. I don't know, that stuff's been inspiring, even though I've otherwise been tired here.
Well, it's funny, you know, because over the summer season for Stick Together, I'm going to do a program about the 8-hour day. I said 8-hour week to somebody and said, I go for that. I go for that.
I would go for that.
But we've got lots of pretty grim headlines, actually. I want to start with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, who's calling on the Albanese government to explain why it has been hiding the contents of a newly released English transcript of a February the 17th interview with Nauruan President David Adiang in an extraordinary example of their ongoing secrecy about the billions in taxpayer dollars they are spending on offshore processing. The government refused to release a separate transcript under FOI and also refused to give it to the Senate, deepening already serious concerns about transparency. As a last resort to get the information on the public record tonight, Senators David Pocock and David Shoebridge have read an English transcript of the interview onto the Senate Hansard under parliamentary privilege, which is, you know, really, you know, going for it.
Mm-hmm.
President Adiang states that individuals have been living safely in the Australian community. As such, Australians deserve to know why the government is spending up to $7 billion to punish them offshore. The transcript also reveals that negotiations for the new offshore agreement have been underway since last year, contradicting the Albanese government's public statements and raising questions about why these details were kept from Australians. The president of Nauru have given his own media more clarity about the deal than the Australian government. A head of advocacy from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre said two different stories are now on the record. One is being told to the people of Nauru and another to the people of Australia. Either the Nauruan president is being dishonest, the Albanese government is being dishonest, or Australia has misled Nauru. No matter which version is true, it exposes a system marked by secrecy, confusion and a lack of accountability and extremely high risk of corruption. The government's secrecy on these issues is part of a wider pattern of corruption and cover-ups that have plagued offshore processing for more than a decade. Millions of taxpayers' dollars have flowed through secretive contracts linked to fraud, biker gangs and mismanagement. An expose by 60 Minutes has recently revealed in detail that one of the contracts for their arrangements are given to a company run by members of the Finx biker gang. Billions have now disappeared into a system built on cruelty and deception. The ASRC is calling on the Albanese government to release all contracts, correspondence and agreements related to offshore processing and offshore warehousing in Nauru and Papua New Guinea. It also calls on the government to end offshore detention and stop outsourcing Australia's legal responsibilities to other nations. A humane, transparent onshore system would protect people's safety, save taxpayer money and restore integrity to Australia's refugee program. You know, of course, that the Nauru option that they've created is to put people who are refugees into indefinite detention.
The solidarity breakfast claim is that we put the government into the people's administration.
Yeah. You got anything else to add?
I feel like the other bit of, kind of changing tack, the other bit of federal news that I've been keeping an eye on this week has been the government succeeding in amending the Federal Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. They managed to pass it by securing a deal with the Greens for better protection of native forests, banning fast tracking of new coal and gas projects and reining in ministerial discretion. I think across the aisle, members of parliament have discussed it being potentially a limited amendment. More needs to be done. Labor's Senator Michelle Ananda Raja described the bill as, quote, not perfect, and the Greens described it as falling woefully short on climate. I think in particular, something that is of interest is that they've managed to include in the amendments what has been described as a pay to destroy offset scheme. So a fund that would essentially allow developers to pay into a restoration fund as a part of the approvals process. So perhaps not up to scratch in terms of actually protecting the environment.
One of the things I find so fascinating about the government's approach to this has been the messages coming out of the government. I actually get on my email for some reason or other, I'm obviously on some sort of list, but the Labor Party sent out a message that congratulates themselves on the passing of the bill, and it tells us why it's so good. And I'll just see if I can find it.
I think one of the other things while you're finding that is that the Labor Party has kind of presented this amendment and this bill as a meeting point between the interests of business and environmental protections, which I think is a red flag.
Oh, it definitely is.
Yes. but I think that's, we've got Don Sutherland coming up on the show later on, and I'd really like to hear his thoughts about the ways that the Labor government and Murray Watt in particular have really courted the interests of businesses and companies that essentially rely on environmental destruction for profit, how central they've been in this process of amending and regulating some of our environmental laws. So I'll be looking forward to talking to Don about that a bit more in the
This is what Murray wants. This is an email that's put out. And its byline is, we've done it. We've passed it, basically. With your support, we're able to deliver on our commitment to strengthen our environmental laws, better protecting the places we love for generations to come. By the end of the week, the Albanese Labor government will establish Australia's first ever independent National Environmental Protection Agency. This will give us an environmental watchdog with real teeth, one clear set of rules, proper monitoring, and real consequences for big business doing the wrong thing. Okay.
I think this is
the key wins. Every project must leave the environment better off.
Mm-hmm.
New strong national environmental standards to improve outcomes and the quality of decision making. Defining unacceptable impacts on matters of national environmental significance for the first time, providing a critical safeguard against irreversible loss. Tell that to the
Jukan Gord.
Strong penalties and enforcement to make sure big businesses do the right thing. Fast-tracking renewable energy projects to assist in the renewable energy transition, read gas. End land clearing to protect more of our precious habitat.
Yeah, Beetaloo Basin.
Yeah, tell us all about it, bright boy.
I do think the kind of saga around establishing the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is a really great demonstration of the kind of hold and reach the fossil fuel industries have over government policy around the environment. I think it's been pretty compellingly reported that Tanya Plibersek was stepped down from the environmental portfolio because she wasn't keeping fossil fuel interests, particularly in Western Australia, happy enough. She was pushing too hard for the EPA to actually be a functional body.
Well, it's interesting. One of the themes in some of my headlines this week is around how the federal government is pushing things through without following proper process.
Mm-hmm.
So the Centre for Public Integrity have put out a warning saying that they're pretty worried about the weak process, strong powers, a troubling legislative trend. And it's particularly about what they're calling the EPBC Act, which is the Environment Act, all those letters. We are deeply concerned by the government's push to progress the EPBC Act reforms, and they always use the word reforms, before the Senate committee has even finished receiving public submissions, and by its earlier rush to pass the FOI amendment bill in the House, again before the relevant committee has reported. We wish we could say these concerns are new in this space, but they are not. Last parliamentary term, we saw this government push through three major reforms to the Commonwealth electoral finance laws with similar flouting of good legislative processes. These moves reflect a troubling disregard for transparency, participatory lawmaking. They come at a cost in terms of good policy, legitimate government, and public trust. And the thing that really showed this was the, you'll remember on our horizon was the issue of conflating police and ministers in cancelling welfare payments for people accused of a serious violent or sexual offence. Now, Labor, the Anti-Poverty Centre have been keeping a really close eye on this, and they've put this forward. The same thing happened when this law has been passed. Today, the government has successfully granted, this is November 26, granted police and ministers new powers to cancel welfare payments for people accused of a serious violent or sexual offence, disposing with the presumption of innocence and removing the right to due process on the simple basis of a person's income. Labor defied calls from 116 legal and academic experts plus 64 organisations representing welfare recipients, First Nations people, people with disability, family violence survivors, legal advocates and community services to abandon Schedule 5, which was introduced as a late amendment to an unrelated Social Security bill on the 29th of October after the Social Security and other legislation amendments. The government has hoped this draconian new power could be slipped in unnoticed, waiting until after inquiries into the bill by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, the Senate Committee, Community Affairs Legislative Committee and Senate Standing Committee for the Security of Bills concluded before quietly introducing it as a bill passed the lower house, since then dogged questioning from senators including Lydia Thorpe, David Pocock and Penny Allman Payne, as revealed Labor's careful scheme to hide this change and avoid all security. So they're using this whole process of getting in major, they are quite draconian outcomes.
Well, it brings us even...
Class war.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here as well, like you've got written, as we go into Disability Week, there's been a whole bunch of HSU, the Health Services Union, amongst other disability advocacy groups, and just civil society has pushed back against the Allen government doing very much the same thing through a child protection bill. They put in a last minute sort of weird little amendment that would see the disability regulator recommended by the Coronial Inquiry into Disability rolled into a greater regulator that would oversee everything from homelessness support to child protection services to disability protection services.
Yep. Yeah, I know. It's extraordinary.
Massively eroding the independent oversight of a body that has been, that is familiar to folks with disability and massively undermining an already failing state government that has recently seen the Victoria Police take charge of similar amendments to extend their powers, now having a designated area in the CBD for the next 6 months. I'll just read maybe just from the National Indigenous Times. Victoria Police have declared the entire Melbourne CBD, along with parts of surrounding suburbs, a designated area for the next 6 months. The declaration will give police expanded stop and search, move on powers across central Melbourne. The order takes effect on Sunday and will remain in place until the 29th of May 2026. With Victoria Police saying that they will be, quote, commencing further safety measures in the CBD ahead of the declaration's beginning. Under the legislation, it is an offence to prevent or resist police conducting a pat-down search, electromagnetic wanding, or removing items of outer clothing such as headwear, scarves, jacket, etc. Police may also require a person to remove any face covering if they reasonably believe it is worn primarily to conceal identity or protect from the effect of crowd-controlling substances, i.e. pepper spray.
That one gets me. You can't protect yourself from pepper spray.
Yeah.
The
thing is that this coincides with a report that the Human Rights Law Centre released, that even though, you know, technically racial profiling in Victoria Police
yes,
has stopped
right.
or whatever, the actual findings are that First Nations are 15 times more likely to be stopped and searched. African people are 27 times more likely to be stopped or chased. While the CBD 6 months, people like to talk about China being authoritarian or something like that. I don't know if they have a 6 month lockdown on a police enforced lockdown in a CBD.
And as Liberty Victoria says, the use of the designated area powers will allow police to circumvent the usual legal safeguards against unwarranted police intrusion. Normally, police require reasonable grounds to suspect that a person is carrying something illegal or prohibited before they can be searched. We also know that the powers will disproportionately be used against First Nation people and other people of colour. We know there are real issues with racial profiling when it comes to searching people. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie DeBayer and Anila, and we're going to move on to some words from that have been supplied by Vivian Langford from Climate Action Show, which you can hear on 5pm Mondays. She collected these voices from the most recent Sydney rally for Palestine. There's introductory comments followed by the voice of Allah, who Al-Alfi Kwasi, who is a playwright and filmmaker.
Right now, Palestinians in Gaza are facing extreme wet weather conditions while under a crippling blockade. Tents are flooded, blankets are wet, people are being forced to sleep in complete discomfort, people are being forced into starvation, and people, limited food is entering Gaza, only junk food. As Bissan in Gaza has put it, this genocide has been re-engineered. While Israel continues its terror campaign in Gaza, the West Bank continues to be subjected to increased raids and settler attacks. Shame. Last month marked the highest rate of settler attacks in the West Bank since 2006. Israel's settler colonial expansion has not ended. It has continued and it has thrived while this genocide in Gaza has been happening right under our eyes. We must not lose sight of the fact that Israel has been able to maintain its system of apartheid and settler colonial expansion over the last 77 years because of support from corporations, because of support from Western governments and even Arab governments, and support from the media as well. And these countries include our very own here in Australia, it includes the US, it includes the UK, it's companies like Elbit Systems, like BAE Systems, it's companies like Quickstep, and it's also the media organisations who keep peddling Zionist talking points and who serve as a conveyor belt for Zionist Israeli propaganda. And despite countless reports from countless human rights organisations and from UN bodies detailing the genocide being committed against Palestinians, the sexual violence being committed against Palestinians, and the illegal occupation and apartheid system operating on stolen land, despite all of this, our governments, the corporations and the media continue to defend, to fund and to maintain diplomatic relations with the illegal Zionist state of Israel. They are all complicit in genocide, and we the people must continue to hold them to account until we see justice for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who've been murdered in cold blood over the last 2 years. Without further ado, I just want to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Alaa. She's a Palestinian activist. She's a filmmaker, a storyteller. Please welcome Alaa.
Thank you all for coming today. I would like to start by reminding ourselves of why we're here today at this right moment. I would like you to revive your intention and remind yourselves of why we coming together today, what made you come today. Remember all the martyrs whose lives were cut too short too soon, all the wounded who are still suffering, all the people now living in tents, suffering from the rains, from the lack of food, from lack of medications. We appreciate everyone's effort, everyone who fought for the Palestinians. And I'll just start with 1 minute of silence to remind ourselves of our martyrs, of our wounded, of our ongoing struggle. You can close your eyes and keep their memories alive. You can pray for them. You can read the Fatiha for them. I begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land, the elders past, present, and emerging, and all First Nations people whose sovereignty was never ceded. I honor the deep suffering they have endured, the massacres, the dispossessions, the forced removals, the attempts to erase culture, language, identity, and memory. The story of this land is a story of a genocide, a truth that still echoes through generations, and the injustices, the silencing, the discrimination, they are not only part of history. They continue in the prisons, in the stolen children, in the inequality, in the constant fight to simply be heard. Because of the world's silence, because of the humanity's silence, this genocide happened on this land. This genocide that was done to the First Nations people here. I arrived on this land as a migrant, but in reality, I became a settler. It's painful to admit, but I became a settler on this land because of a genocide that happened to my land and is still going here and there. I became part of a story written long before I arrived, a story built on invasion, displacement, and attempted erasure. And in that way, without choosing it, I became connected to another genocide, another ongoing injustice. When we are silent about one people's destruction, we open the door for another people's destruction. When we let one injustice pass, we give permission for the next one. It all began with one intention, with greed, with hunger for power, with racism, with one human believing he is superior to another. And when societies accepted that lie, when they tolerated it, when they allowed it to grow without resistance, the pattern repeated itself from continent to continent, from generation to another. And today we see the same system in Palestine. We see it in Gaza, in Sudan, in Congo, and everywhere. We see it in every land where human lives are treated as disposable. By stopping the genocide in Palestine, we're stopping this system everywhere. When we defend one oppressed nation, we defend all oppressed nations. When we fight for justice in one land, we weaken the machinery of injustice in every land. How can I unsee what I've seen? How can I unsee what I've seen? How can any of us unsee it? Once our eyes open to the truth, there is no returning to the sleep we once lived in. Palestine did this to us. It's our spiritual compass, a place that pulled the entire world back to its core, back to its origins, back to the humanity buried underneath layers of destruction and deception. For years, the global system taught us to look away, scroll past, to normalize death, to laugh and perform our shallow versions of life online, while the same system profited from its suffering, from our suffering, from the genocide, from occupation, from the destruction of entire nations. A system that needs people numb, distracted, divided, unaware. But Palestine shattered that illusion. It exposed the machinery behind the curtain, a machinery that has operated in Iraq and Afghanistan and Sudan and Congo and everywhere. For decades we were told that we were separated, it's complicated, isolated the tragedies, but Palestine showed us the threats, the same systems of power, the same imperial interests, the same political structures shaping the destructions of lives. And out of that darkness, we come together. Something very miraculous happened humanity began to awaken. We started seeing each other again. We began to feel each other's pain as our own. People from every country, every language, every faith, every color. It no longer matter where you come from, what your skin looked like, what religion you follow, because in the deepest place within us, we recognize each other. Your core is my core. We come from the same source. That is the only truth that matters. And now, even if the bombs stop falling in Gaza, Palestine is not yet free. Our struggle is not done yet. Sudan is not free. Congo is not free. First Nations people here on this land are still fighting. They're not free. Wounds do not close just because the rest of the world moves on. Stopping the violence doesn't dismantle the system that created it. And so we cannot stop. We must keep pushing, keep mobilizing, keep speaking, keep awakening every person, every heart that still sleeps in the comfort of ignorance. But we do it with love, with unity, with understanding that this moment of global awareness is one of the greatest gifts Palestine has given the world. A reminder that humanity is still alive, still capable of compassion, still capable of rising together. And as part of my journey, of my healing journey through the dark times that we lived together, looking at our phones in the long nights, watching a live stream genocide, I created a play called The Return. It's a play that I wrote as I tried to find sense of this horrible situation that didn't make sense to anyone. I spoke about it in the rallies before, and today I offer it again as my gift to you, my pro-Palestine community, to every free human who refuses to look away. This work is inspired by Rozan and Nagam Abu Samra, two beautiful young women from Gaza whose lives were taken so short. It was cut too short. They were taken so brutally and so unjustly. And it is dedicated to their father, Marwan Abu Samra, a man who taught me what it truly means to be a human. He taught me resilience. He taught me patience, mercy, love. He taught me how to live life, how to make life even when it was impossible. How he taught me to cling to hope when hope felt impossible. So today I stand here not just to speak but to remember, to honor and to refuse to unsee. And I want to end this with words that Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, gave us. Words that gave us courage so we resist. We stand together against oppression. We refuse to be erased. حاصر حصارك لا مفر اضرب عدوك لا مفر سقطت ذراعك فالتقطها وسقطت قربك فالتقطني واضرب عدوك بي فأنت الآن حر وحر وحر. Besiege your siege, there is no escape. Strike your enemy, there is no escape. If your arm falls, lift it again. If I fall beside you, lift me too, and strike your enemy with me. Long live the resistance. Long live the resistance in its all shapes and forms. Armed resistance, soft resistance, our resistance is still alive. Thank you so much, and free Palestine.
It's a government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans, but too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/ suck eggs. To learn more, the Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
That was pretty groovy. That was almost like an Hawaiian Arab song.
You got to listen to the lyrics. That's a Palestinian band called Tariq from the 80s, or the early 80s, late 70s. Very, very good album that I'd highly recommend. You'll find it linked in the Solidarity Breakfast podcast page.
Yeah, okay. And we've got Zane, who's up at the Rising Tide event that's going on at the moment. Tell us all about what's going on, Zane.
So I am up in sunny Mullumbimby, Newcastle, at the People's Blockade of the world's largest coal port. This has not happened every year since 2005, but there's been at least a dozen of them since then. And this is set to be the largest one yet. There was about 7,000 people here last year. It's looking like numbers are going to eclipse that this year. So there's a big tent city. There's large marquees and meeting places. There's lots of little tents set up where people are camping. And we're going to be using people power to blockade what is the world's largest coal exporting port. And about 80 to 85% of what gets exported out of the Port of Newcastle is thermal coal for power stations. There's, you know, there's a complex discussion to be had about coking coal that's used in steel production, but the bulk of what's going out of here is power stations, and that's the low-hanging fruit that we need to get rid of and replace with renewables. So it's a plumb target, it's a choke point, and it's eminently possible to shut it down with lots of people, and that's what we're doing.
And there's been, last year, there was a lot of effort made by the New South Wales government to try and suppress this kind of demonstration, and they were unsuccessful, weren't they? And the local council were behind, were actually quite supportive of the gathering.
Yes. So, actually, the Newcastle had a Labor Lord Mayor for quite a while, and last year there was an Independent Lord Mayor, Ross Kerridge, elected. He was supportive of the blockade last year, and then he kind of changed his tune a little bit after there was an arrestable action. He said, oh, I don't know so much. Unfortunately, this guy, you know, as much as I disagree with him changing his position about the blockade, he's getting treated for cancer at the moment. And so the acting Lord Mayor is Charlotte McCabe, who's from the Greens, and she is very supportive of the blockade. So that's very handy because having the council on side really helps a lot in terms of us being able to camp here in the Foreshore Park. And, yes, the Labor government of Chris Minns really were quite clumsy last year in trying to stop the blockade. They used special events legislation. Port Newcastle has lots of coal ships going through it, but you also just have people in their tinny going out to go fishing and, you know, people going for a paddle on canoes. And there's special events legislation that says if there is a regatta or speedboats or some sort of special event, then the state government is allowed to shut down the port to allow that facility, that event to happen safely. And they tried to use that legislation to stop the blockade, and it was like, well, okay, what's the special event that you're excluding us from the port for? And they said the special event is the blockade, and the Supreme Court in New South Wales said, nice try, New South Wales government. You can't use that legislation to exclude people from their own event. So that was pretty funny.
That's so loony.
But they have created a, under different type of legislation, they've created a maritime exclusion zone. So they've given us a little strip of Horseshoe Beach where we're allowed to be in the water, and they've put out some yellow buoys, and then beyond that, we're not meant to go into the shipping channel.
So now, we'll now see. I know that the MUA would have stopped ships because, and rather the harbour master stopped ships because of safety concerns, which is a right and proper thing to do, right?
So the blockade's been happening since 2005, and for the first year or two, they tried to plough ships through the blockade.
Ooh.
You did have small numbers of people paddling out in front of the ships. It created a safety issue. So from the kind of late noughties until the also the 2023 blockade, ships were stopped. However, last year, as part of this aggressive new approach by the Minns government, they did once again send ships through, which I found quite disturbing. Coming from a sort of OHS perspective, I think it's lunacy sending ships through when you've got groups of people on the sidelines. And it was that context in which a bunch of people took part in an arrestable action last year, paddled out into the shipping lane as a giant empty coal ship was coming into the port to be loaded up. And this forced the coal ship to have to turn around at late notice. And that was the first time that the people's blockade has actually caused a ship to have to turn around. So I think the harbour master on safety grounds should be shutting down the port with this many people, you know, blockading on the edges. But
yep.
I, from what I understand, they will be trying to send ships through today, which I think is just madness. But that's the coal industry.
We'll see what happens.
People in Parliament and in high places.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about the demands that Rising Tide's making?
Yeah, sure. So Rising Tide has three demands. Number one, immediately cancel all new fossil fuel projects. I think that's pretty incontrovertible. And we've got a lot of coal seam gas activists here. There's three more up in the Northern Territory who've been fighting coal seam gas in the Beetaloo Basin. Some of them have been involved in the Save the Burrup campaign. There's people from campaign to stop coal seam gas mining in the Pilliga. So I'll try and find some people that's
been here.
So as, this is a blockade of a coal port, but it's also sort of a lightning rod and a focal point for activists from across the land who are opposing fossil fuel projects. And it's kind of welcoming for all of those who, you know, it's one struggle and one fight.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why
the demand is to tax fossil fuel export profits at 78% to fund community and industrial transition and pay for climate loss and damage. Norway taxes their oil exports at 78%, and they've got a $2 trillion sovereign wealth fund to show for it, and they can fund all sorts of decent services and, you know, a solid welfare state in Norway. We could have something like that here in Australia, but typically, because our governments are captured by multinational fossil fuel and mining interests, the resources stolen off Aboriginal land are practically given away for free, and there's very little to show for it. And that's a big issue here, because as the world stops using coal, or indeed as we put the brakes on our coal exports for climate action, there are a bunch of workers who currently work in that industry who are going to need other jobs to go to. And so the key part of that demand is to free up the cash to be able to invest in alternative job creation in the region, so that those workers aren't put in a position where they're needing to choose between staying in the coal job or becoming unemployed. And there is high unemployment in the region, and certainly in the Upper Hunter. So it's a very live and serious issue. And then the final demand, end all coal exports from Newcastle by 2030. That's frankly pretty ambitious. I don't know if we're quite going to get that one across the line, but the Rising Tide have been doing this blockade since 2020, and spokespeople for the coal industry, including, unfortunately, some in the union movement, have said, oh, you can't just shut coal exports overnight. Well, by the time we get to 2030, Rising Tide will have been doing these protests for a quarter of a century.
Exactly.
So it's, I don't think you can call a quarter of a century overnight.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's, I think, the union movement leaves a bit to be desired in terms of really pushing for a transition. But I also think, compared to 20 years ago when we did the first blockade, there has been a lot of progress in that space. There's the 100 Jobs Alliance now, and there are people around the union movement who I think are pretty... they can see the writing on the wall for the coal industry, the need for a transition, and they know that Rising Tide are not the enemy of workers.
Hey, Zane, what does your day look like? What's going to happen for you?
So I'm going to be... taking a small bag with a phone and wallet and personal possessions from a family member, because they might be doing something that involves them not wanting to have those things on them. I'm going to be a contact person, just in case these people might happen to enter into His Majesty's custody. I'm going to be going down to the beach. There's a sort of a family-friendly kickoff day where there'll be sandcastle building, and the beach where we do the blockade is a dog beach, so there's going to be a cutest dog competition or some sort of thing along those lines. and then I believe at 11 o'clock is when the big paddle out starts. And then later on today, there's going to be a bunch of live music playing at a stage in a park right near the beach. And I'm really looking forward to seeing The Herd, who back in the day, little underground bands would play at the blockade. And these days, now that it's got bigger, you're getting much more high-profile mainstream artists like The Herd, Lime Cordial, Montaigne, Mudrat are going to be performing over the weekend. So, yeah. After our interview, I'm going to be going down and getting some breakfast, and there's a mob there called the Turbo Cooks, and the quality of the food here at the blockade, I've got to say, has just been superb.
Well, thank you for delaying your culinary delights.
And if there's any listeners, this is going to be happening again this time next year. I know Mullumbimby Newcastle is a long way away. It's 1,000 k's from Melbourne. But once you've come here once, you'll get it. you'll see those massive coal ships lining up to get filled up, and you'll enjoy the beautiful vibes here, and you'll probably be wanting to come back again in 2027. So I'd really encourage people. It is a bit of a mish to get up here, but it's a very, there's a real sense of community power here, and it's a beautiful event and powerful.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Awkward Giraffe presents the Festival of Critical Comedy 2025 on the weekend of the 29th and 30th of November, 2 p.m. to 8 at the Melbourne Unitarian Peace Church, 110 Grey Street, East Melbourne. Awkward Giraffe promotes comedy to make you think. Lineup includes comedy legends Greg Fleet and Nick Sun, and the groundbreaking Ridiculousness and Doppelgangster, and much more. Free entry. For more details, see awkwardgiraffe.net. Awkward Giraffe proudly supports 3CR.
And we're back, and we're moving straight on to having a chat with Tom from Tom Feibin, who's from RAC, Refugee Action Collective. And the reason why we've got you on, Tom, is because there's a major exhibition coming up today, as well as a rally tomorrow. So do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about the 25-year of a Refugee Resistance exhibition?
Yeah, thanks so much, Amy. Today we're putting on an exhibition showcasing 25 years of refugee resistance. It will be held in Footscray at Mama Chen's, which is about 5 minutes walk from Footscray Station. And we'll be looking at the history of refugees and supporters' opposition to successive governments' racist policies against refugees, starting from John Howard to the current Albanese government. RAC itself was formed in the year 2000. We're a democratic grassroots activist organization. Looking at this history, I think, has a lot of lessons in terms of how we can oppose the current government's racist policies for refugees, and looking at those significant wins that the movement has had over that time. I can list a few, but just one of them is evacuating the kids off offshore detention under Morrison, which was a massive victory for the movement at the time.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's an issue that just keeps giving. Every time you save one group of people, they just come up with another rather draconian and unpleasant method to torture these people a little bit more.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. And it's certainly what we've seen now with the Albanese government. New laws around being able to deport up to 80,000 people to Nauru, and all of those exposés that we've seen around biker gangs and the Prime Minister of Nauru saying that pretending that the people that are being sent there aren't refugees when they absolutely are.
Yeah. You're going to, at that opening today at 4 p.m. at Mama Chang's, which is 42A Albert Street in Footscray, you've got speakers. Pamela Kerr is always a great person to go to listen to.
Yes, we've got Pamela Kerr, who's a long-time refugee advocate and a past campaign organizer for the ASRC. Actually, when I first got involved in the refugee campaign in 2016, she spoke on university campus about the situation on Nauru at that time, where it was an absolute crisis there. So she's really, hearing from her is going to be really important and really valuable in terms of how we can continue the fight for refugees. The other speaker that we have is Ravi Bartlow, who is a co-founder of Refugee Women Action for Visa Equality. She helped set up the powerful encampment outside of, at the time, Claire O'Neill's office, and then that moved to the Department of Home Affairs in Docklands and lasted 100 days. That was an encampment calling for the government to grant up to 10,000 people permanent visas. These are people that have been living in the community for over 12 years on 3 to 6 month bridging visas, who've had no job security, no work rights, et cetera. the government, the Albanese government, has scrapped the policy that made that possible, but it hadn't granted permanent visas to that cohort. And that site was one of the significant, was, I think, absolutely inspiring, one of the most recent highlights of refugee resistance. So hearing from her will be fantastic as well.
I agree with you, and incredibly persistent and imaginative in the approach for creating activist voices to the fore. But of course, tomorrow is a rally that's been called at 11:30 at State Library, and this is an anti-racism rally that responds to a rather appalling event, a racist campaign put Australia First is rallying in Australia, in Melbourne, and they're actually going to do a live link to an English racist.
That's right, and the person they're linking to is a fascist, UK's most prominent fascist, Tommy Robinson, who's a thug, who's a racist, who's a sexist, who led those violent racist marches of 100,000 or so people in the UK recently. So it's an absolute disgrace that rally's happening, and absolutely anyone who considers themselves an anti-racist should come and should join the counter demonstration. RAC is going to have a contingent at that rally. We aren't the hosts of that rally, but we're having our own contingent there. Well, we'll be marching in an orderly fashion to say that these kinds of racists are not welcome here. Migrants and refugees are not to blame for the crisis of living standards, the housing, and for the real pain that many people are feeling in this country. But that the blame should go to the government, and it's the scapegoat to blame migrants. But also to point out that it's the policies of the Albanese government around those new deportation laws, which like I said, allow up to 80,000 people to deport, it, that emboldens these kinds of racists to come out on the streets and say, put this into action. We want those mass deportations. So I think that the government has a responsibility in terms of not emboldening these racists, and part of that is to have humane refugee policies and not what we're seeing today.
Thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Tom. And just to remind you that the rally is 11:30, State Library, tomorrow.
Thanks so much for having me on, Annie.
3CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
A week solidarity, Bricky team listener, when we remember former Minister for Stuffing Up the Environment, Tania Plibersek, sacked because she had the heretical idea that an environment protection bill should do something to protect the environment. Upsetting Western Troubler Aussie Supremo Roger Cook the Planet and his fossil puppeteers, and in turn Big Supremo Anthony Albanese, buckling at the knee to the thought he may upset the puppeteers. Thus, exit Tania and enter stage right, new Minister for Woodside with Profits Murray Swatch the Environment, carrying out his orders to produce an environment protection bill guaranteed to protect the fossils, eradicate the annoying red and especially green tape delaying the inevitable approvals, with Anthony again intervening this time to ensure the fossil protection bill succeeded. Anthony and Murray's commitment to the environment epitomised by their offer to do a deal with the caring business class, hayseed and sheepshit parties coalition, or the economy-destroying Greens. We'll make the Protect the Fossils even stronger if you support us to the one. We'll make Protect the Fossils just a little less strong if you support us to the other. Can we think of a more principled commitment to protect the environment? Which does get a look in, by the way. It's in the name of the bill. Unfortunately, such commitment can bring out the irrational negatives, like a full-page ad by that long-haired, commie, greeny front, the Troubler Aussie Institute. Environment laws that don't stop new coal and gas projects, it raves, and then a huge, huge, are useless. attacking the poor, innocent socialists for nothing more than emission increases, expanding coal and gas with another 94 projects in the pipeline, emissions from fossil exports, and even criticising Murray's approval of the Woodside with profits gas, gas, gas until 2070, failing to acknowledge that all that is part of the necessary transition we have to have the transition. But were they put in their place? I'll preface this. This item proves the argument that we need more women in positions of influence to bring that woman's touch to issues. For instance, borne out this week by that appalling Hoon son of No Notion, as appalling as ever, and a wonderful contribution by our filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina, in a speech for National Mining Day last Saturday. As a by-the-by, wasn't aware it was National Mining Day, or I would have alerted you, listener, so we could have spent the day in a huge celebration, midnight to midnight, so we wouldn't miss a minute of the fun. Anyway, Gina, with her normal thinking only of others and the common good selflessness, attacked other great resource behemoths, Rio Tinto the planet and the big true blue Aussie BHP for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, imploring shareholders to demand answers from the boards, wasting billions on emissions reduction while productivity stagnates. Your dividends are being sacrificed on the green altar. Her wisdom shone through. Stand up against the watermelons. Yes, picking up something we've been warning for years. Green on the outside, red on the inside. And please don't forget providing facts to your children so they are not left anxious and terrified by the far-left garbage they are taught at school. Poor dear little children, far-left garbage like there is such a thing as climate change. Quoting that ever-reliable source of truth and balance, the Institute of Public, very, very private affairs, that true blue Aussies want energy affordability and reliability. And no doubt that's true, but, never mind. Gina then displayed her warm, cuddly side. I don't want the millions of true blue Aussies on low income struggling in increasing poverty. See, she really cares. I am deeply concerned for our country's future if we rush further down this net zero anti-mining path. And apart from being our richest mining pather, Gina is also our biggest pastoralist. Thus, the green transition is also threatening agriculture. See? Selfless. Thank you, Gina, for that woman's touch. But oh, that common sense was quickly scotched by Carmen Lawrence, the first woman state premier, Western True Blue Aussie Socialist Party premier, who attacked the Socialist Environment Bill. Turncoat. It's a failure of the duty of care owed to every True Blue Aussie, to the places and species we love, and to our children's future. The government's own data shows we must slash coal and gas production, yet there is even more coal and gas in the approvals pipeline, she raved on and on. Anthony Albanese once argued for a climate trigger in our environment law, but now downplays the climate impacts which flow from the flood of his government's coal and gas approvals. Thank goodness Western True Blue Aussie now has Roger Cook the planet looking after the environment. And thank goodness, Anthony and the team also have struck the right balance in their economic policy, providing trillions to bail out great resource giants struggling with their electricity bills in their aluminium plants. Forget that many of them make trillions worldwide from their other pollution pursuits. Thus, they call on the True Blue Aussie taxpayer to pick up the bill. Resource giant Tomago Public Purse, for instance, the socialists agreeing to socialise its electricity bill, providing power from Stowey Hydros, charging them a bit, but picking up the gap between the bit charged and the real cost. Energy experts said the subsidies would amount to billions of dollars, true figure, but it's all part of getting the balance right. For that story was True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review P1 Monday. Then, very next day, P1, government plans to slash the public sector. Responding to caring business class concerns, it's spending too much on the public service. Now, it is just possible that the increased spending is replacing the sensible spending on consultants this government inherited, that it is transitioning back to the public service doing what the public service is supposed to do. But be that as it may, by Wednesday, socialists to cut $5.6 billion from public sector. Money much better spent bailing out the world's resource giants. At least 7,000 people headed for the unemployed scrap heap. And headed for the human scrap heap, former state supremo Daniel Anscrews the workers. If expatriate great Troubler Aussie Jamie Puker has his way, Daniel ruined his life by, what a cruel thing to do, changing the way casinos were taxed. Although why people who don't pay any tax in the first place get so upset about it, we've got no idea. He's not only ruined Victoria, he also ruined my life. Oh dear, poor Jamie. I think he's human filth. And Jamie said Crook casino rival Star Crook had been much worse than Crook, and Crook had never been charged with any offence. Bit of a pity then that the very next day, screaming headline, Crook cops $100 million fine. That's the Crook that hadn't been charged with anything. Worth pointing out, a then Her Most Gracious Majesty's Royal Commission found poor innocent never been charged with anything Crook breached its social and moral obligations, resulting in illegal activities, tax avoidance, money laundering, criminal associations, and considerable harm to the vulnerable. A modest little list of innocent behaviour. Now, I'm sure, listener, we would have lots and lots of criticisms of Daniel, but none of them to do with poor Jamie's ruined life. And like Gina, who made a compassionate speech just after returning from a little newly acquired Mar-a-Lago pad where she had been discussing how to make the world a better place with her neighbour, US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor. Donald's having a bit of trouble, by the way, convincing recalcitrant not holding the cards Ukraine to surrender to his very close friend Vlad the Invader. Wonder if Jamie bemoaned his ruined life from his not inexpensive of little Tel Aviv pad next door to his very, very close friend Benjamin Not Another Yahoo. Benjamin forced to slaughter lots of people in Beirut, not in breach of the ceasefire deal, and the ongoing slaughter of non-land, non-people in Gaza and the West Bank, not in breach of the ceasefire. Beside, Beirut, Gaza, the West Bank are all between the river and the sea, thus illegally occupied by the Lebanese and non-land, non-people. With its renowned balance, the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin listed the top 20 education power brokers in Victoria, led by that dedicated socialist, the Minister Ben Corral to myself, dedicated especially to Ben Corral to myself. There's vice-chancellors, private school principals, big end-of-town legal partners, financiers, private Catholic state principals associations, power brokers. Therefore, doesn't take a genius to work out who's missing, who Lord Rupert doesn't see as powerful or important in the education system. Yes, got it. The lazy avaricious workers and their evil union. Perhaps they ran 21st. No. After all, what would they know about education compared to the powerful, to financiers, the big end of town lawyers, and Ben? We mentioned how that appalling and Gina did so much to provide that woman's touch to the public sphere, and how that iconoclast Carmen Lawrence did the opposite. Well, another to join that appalling and Gina. The week that was joins the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin in recommending that all women erect the hugest plinth possible, real or virtual, and place Zana Parley right up there as the perfect feminist role model. Zana, who I hear? How ignorant. Zana Parley, 34-year-old Brighton property developer and sometime contestant on one of those so-called reality unreal telly shows, taking on the world, the Wapping Sin informed us, heading to Italy for the Miss Europe Continental Beauty Contest, armed with two $20,000 evening gowns. The Lord Rupert telling us who the elite label is. Zani, mum of two, now with a new partner, and full of wise advice for all women. I am really excited. I put myself out there, and I do show other women that you can achieve things all by yourself. What profound advice. And so modest. All by herself, with a little help from 40 grand of haute couture, and a 34-year-old property developer, reality unreal, mum, Miss Europe Continental Beauty. That should inspire all women to achieve anything they want all by themselves. Now, another woman, Hur al-Qasimi, an Emirati princess, is a prominent curator and organizer of festivals and events, respected worldwide, working on major shows in Sharjah and Japan and also next March's Sydney Biennale. Only problem is, she's a pro-non-land, non-people activist. And the problem? Rich Zionists have withdrawn their support, sponsorships, and property mogul More Profit Fact, which had signed up, has unsigned up. The Zionist lobby declaring with her appointment there were grave concerns for one of our flagship cultural institutions becoming a tool of ideology and exclusion. Thus, for non-ideological reasons, they want to exclude her, even though she said she was raised to respect everybody's culture and religion. Anyway, she's managed to get an Emirates-based global, including True Blue Aussie property developer, to come to the financial rescue, allowing the Biennale, quote, to amplify diverse voices and explore histories that shape our sense of identity and belonging. Does that help? Well, no. Finally, those who withdraw their support now attack the new sponsor. Whichever way she goes, Hur al-Qasimi can't win. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Kevin. And on the line, we've got Don Sutherland from down in Tasmania, who's going to talk to us about living standards and nature, the new threat from the stock exchange. How are you today, Don?
I'm pretty good, Annie, and hello to you and all your listeners, and congratulations on what's been a terrific program this morning.
Oh, that's very fine of you.
Yes, well, I think it's about a month since I've been on, I think, and particularly last week. I'm finding it hard to keep up with what's happening because I think we are living in quite stupendous times, quite astonishing at times. Last week, I think, listeners will recall that I often like to talk about the interacting crises, and I think there are five principal ones, and within those, probably the most important is the ecological economics dimension of the confluence of crises. And last week, I think in all of them, big things happened, and very important things, and including the crisis in human relations, where the struggle against racism and against misogyny, two dimensions of the crisis in human relations, intensified. There's some very positive developments, I think, for those of us who are anti-racist and who are anti-misogynist. It's a bit of a clumsy way of putting it. However, the two things that I think I feel capable of being able to talk about is the interaction between what happened with the new environment laws in the Parliament with what's happening in the economy, particularly one aspect of that being the stock exchange, the stock markets.
As they said, $59 billion was wiped from the Australian Stock Exchange, apparently.
Yeah, that's from the Australian Stock Exchange, and there is even bigger numbers were happening in the USA and other major share markets. And since then, it's sort of stabilised and recovered, sort of. But we are now in a period of volatility in stock markets. And my hunch is that that's not very well understood what that means in our left and beyond that. In progressive organisations, particularly unions and environmental organisations.
Because there's a difference between the play money that the gamblers on the stock exchange are playing with and what happens in our real productive, real life, isn't there?
Yeah, well, in a way, the way in which they do gamble and calling it play money diminishes the potential damage, havoc, that it causes back in the real world. And in that article, I've tried to lay out just how that works. You see, when there is the buying and selling of shares, as has been, and the share market is going upwards, then superficially, that doesn't seem to be much damage being done back in the real economy. But when it collapses, when there's a wipeout, then that does reverberate back. And that's where we are now. We're in a period where it's fragile and it's volatile. And that will reverberate back into the employers, big and small, expecting and pushing governments to put downward pressure on living standards and to diminish government spending commitments about the environment and climate change. And this is a big point of struggle. And so what the...
So what you're really saying is that there's a very large demarcation between the interests of capital and the interests of ordinary people, with the not just the economy at stake, but actually the environment that we live in at stake. We need a new system, effectively.
See, in the real world, there are twin exploitations happening in any capitalist society like ours. And that is the exploitation of people and of nature. Now, they do not proceed in parallel, as most unions and most environment organisations think, even when they look across the divide and see that there are problems on that other parallel. In fact, they're interactive. And I think that we've got to develop a more powerful ecological economics, if you like, or a more powerful political economic ecology practice. That's what's coming out for me. When you look at what's going on in the stock exchange, it's not going to stay stable. The history of capitalism shows that about every 7, sometimes every 10 years, there is a not just wipeouts, but a big collapse in stock exchange values, and that does reverberate. And that means that governments have a huge choice to make. Will they act in a way that is entirely consistent with the requirements of big capital, or will they go the opposite direction and look after the people and look after nature? And we haven't yet had any situation, any of those previous crises have never delivered, never seen a government that sides completely with the people or with nature.
So beyond the role of government, you've kind of talked a bit in your recent article about the need for more union involvement and community involvement in marrying those concerns around the environment and the economy. So in practical terms, what can organisations like unions be doing to counteract some of this economic instability that you've been discussing?
Well, I think the very first thing that unions must drive is a lot more member education about the political economy of the world we live in right now. That means integrating into that the ecological issues about what's happening with nature, because nature is not infinite, it's finite. And every economic action is dependent upon taking stuff out of nature. And so that's the first thing, a much more serious political economy education by the union movement as it currently is with its current members, but then extending and pushing that. Now, that should be the foundation for a lot deeper consideration and engagement and involvement of workers in developing proposals for socially useful development. In other words, instead of saying that business leaders and business organisations and boards of companies are the only ones capable of coming up with future development proposals, that can also come from unions and their members. And that ought to be, doesn't always have to be, but it ought to have a tone of challenging and seeking to replace the momentum of profit-taking that lies in, of course, capitalist control over development.
What you're saying is changing the focus of what society's economy is supposed to be doing. So that leads into another thing that you put forward, which is resisting austerity.
Well, if we do, it's not going to be it. It'll be if and when it happens that there is a collapse. And it's hard to know exactly when it will be. The expectation will be to make the people pay, and that expectation will be put upon governments. And that means that there will have to be a rejigging of even the very modest and weak claims that this Labor government can make about fairer budgets, that is, the relationship between taxation and spending. And so there'll be pressure on for austerity on the industrial wage and austerity in terms of taxation and social service spending. And we are seeing signs of that already. Just this past week, of course, the government has asked all of the public service department mandarins to begin reviewing their budgets, their current spending patterns, and identifying the items of least priority that might be sacrificed. Now, who knows where that will go, given that most of those mandarins are neoliberals. That's where they come from. That's the tradition they come out of. And so I can see downward pressure on the quality and quantity of services that go to the general public.
And this is at the same time as of an increase in public money going to corporate welfare, to fossil fuel companies, basically.
Yeah, well, the corporate welfare spend is, this government is right into it, and there is very little quid pro quo for the public in that, except the expectation that will be more jobs. But there is a big contradiction there.
I don't think that's really floating anymore.
Yeah. It is absolutely necessary that there be loads of new investment, public and private, in socially useful technologies that will make a difference in the future for both people and nature. We will need new technologies to not just slow down global warming, but to reverse it. We will. Now, the problem is that the more of that private investment that occurs, and I'll come back to just with a quick fact about that in a minute, but the more that occurs, then it requires, if profits are to be made out of it, which is what the employers are looking for, that there be an increase in the rate of exploitation of the workforce through the wages-profit relationship. This is a contradiction that governments tend not to pay too much attention to, unless, of course, it leads to so much strike action that there has to be some intervention to stop that. So we have these ongoing contradictions in the way in which it's all going to play out, in my view. The issue of fact is that we've just had the first sign that there might be a reversal in the volume of productive capital spending by the private sector for a number of years. And that new data came out, delivered by the Australian Bureau of Statistics last week. Well done to all the workers there who do such a good job producing that information. Whatever its deficiencies in various ways, that's not their fault. But the important thing about it was the centrality in that lift in private sector investment of data centres.
Yeah, their investment's going into data centres, which of course is another really big environmental problem.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They use incredible levels of water. It's just a disaster in the making.
It's not just data centres, but they were the big ticket item in the latest new data. And that, in some ways, has an encouraging aspect to it, but as you say, that means a more intense exploitation of nature because of its requirements for water, from water supply and electricity. So all of these things are contradictory, and so we're going to get a lot of conflict, a lot of tension around all of these things, and our union and environment organisations have to switch on and work out how each can say things about their priorities that are supportive of each other, directly supportive. And I think one of the interesting things in your interview with the activist from Newcastle was he made a point of discussing, from an environmentalist point of view, the participation and involvement of unions and workers in the actions in Newcastle.
Yeah, the future. We have to come up, we're coming to the end, so you have to do a final statement here.
Well, the final bit in this in this rough jigsaw, of course, is what happened with the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Bill that is now an act of Parliament.
I know. Correct.
Now, my challenge to socialists like myself is that be careful of what you say until you've read it. I think it's beholden on us to be more sophisticated than we normally are and actually develop our critique of it on the basis of having read it. And the things that I would be looking for is firstly, and I have hunches about this, but I'd want to read it to be sure, is that does this actually reverse or just slow down the exploitation of nature? My hunch will be, subject to reading it, is that it's just slowing it down somewhat. Now, that's not a bad thing, because the character of the bill is that it's one that's been worked out with a very different role for the Greens. And that momentum shift is not insignificant for us who want to see things happen in a bigger way and a better way and faster. It's a momentum shift that is modest, that is holds some promise if we are smart about it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to finish it there, and we'll put a link to your article so people can perhaps make more comment directly to you about their thoughts on this particular subject. Thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
And watch out for what the Tasmanian socialists have to say about the new Macquarie Point Stadium in Hobart.
Okay, and mate. Bye.
All the best, everybody.
And that's it for Solidarity this morning. Tell us what you had to say, Tobias.
I have a quick little spot for Calliope X, who we've interviewed before, both Georgias we've interviewed. Calliope X Speaks is an annual fundraiser event to raise funds for future contributors for the online literary journal. This Sunday, November 30th, at Capers in Thornbury, 5 p.m. onwards, they're putting on a night of poetry and music featuring Amanda Anastasi, Manishu Eljani, Ender Bashkin, Tony Birch, Alina Gomez, Michaela Sahar, Elif Sezen, Oyung Yu, and with music from the Black Sea Ensemble. It's a volunteer-run collective and journal that platforms a wide cross-section of the Australian and international literary scene, including emerging writers. And go and check it out. I've got a little quote here from George who said, "Come and support and stick it to the dominant vanilla wafer gargoyles of Oz lit and culture and their self-righteous tape loops of diversity and inclusion. As Malcolm X said, who is he to be equal with?"
Okay, sayonara. And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.